from the right? Stay a while. We may change your thinking. This is Portland's Talk, 620 KPOJ.
Welcome back to the Norman Goldman Show. I'm Adam Klugman, sitting in for Norman Goldman. This is the place where justice is served and where fierce independence is the norm. So I just went off. I did something audacious. I had the audacity to rewrite the president's speech a couple of weeks ago in Osawatomie, Kansas, because I felt that what's missing is the inspiration and the truth. And I think that the president underestimates what would happen if he spoke the truth. I think politicians really underestimate what would happen if they spoke the truth. Whenever we see glimmers of it, you know, you see these kind of people who skyrocket. I think of Alan Grayson. Remember when he got on the floor of the House and said that the Republican plan was don't get sick, and if you do get sick, die quickly. Because it was the truth, and the truth galvanizes people. We know the truth. We feel the truth. And sometimes I feel that President Obama is blowing something of historic proportions, an opportunity to really redirect the country in an entirely different direction. And we need to do that. This is a matter of our survival anymore. This isn't optional. These aren't just optional values. We have to redirect not just our own country, but the whole trajectory of the world and all of its business so that we can survive. And we need the truth. So what do you think? Am I completely out of my mind? Did I go way over the top? 1-888-321-6001 are the numbers. That's 1-888-321-6001. If you're a little shy, you can join us on Facebook at the Norman Goldman Show. Or you can send me an email at adam@madashellinamerica.com. This is the place where fierce independence is the norm.
Let's have smart talk. Something better than yelling for no reason. This is Portland's Talk, 620 KPOJ.
Welcome back to the Norman Goldman Show. I'm Adam Klugman, sitting in for Norman Goldman. This is the place where justice is served, and I want to give a big shout out to Norm for letting me sit in for him on this Christmas Hanukkah Kwanzaa season, and I hope you're having an excellent holiday season. I know that I am, and being here is part of it. Let's go to calls. I just went off on a speech that I wish President Obama would have written. Someone posted on the Facebook page, I don't want a list of quoting me. I don't want a list of achievements because I don't want to bash him, and then attributed it to the Obama basher's credo. I really don't want to bash the guy. I don't take any pleasure in bashing the guy. I just want him to step up and be the guy that he promised he would be. All right, let's go to Sean in Seattle. Sean, welcome to the Norman Goldman Show. You're on with Adam Klugman.
Hey, Adam. Hey,
Sean.
I really enjoyed your intro, but I think what most of us are really confused about is why aren't Democrats behaving like Democrats? I come from a railroad family. You know, a lot of people were, you know, working on the railroad when I was a kid. And in 1978, Jimmy Carter deregulated the transportation sector of the economy. And so, you know, I've been hearing this for years now. Why aren't Democrats behaving like Democrats? Bill Clinton repealed Glass-Steagall. He passed welfare reform. He passed NAFTA and GATT.
Right.
And so I think what we really need to examine is where did all of these good programs come from? Things like Social Security, things like the minimum wage, things like unemployment insurance.
40-hour work week, weekends. Yeah,
exactly.
It goes on and on.
And what I keep coming back to is that what we really need to think of the Democratic Party as, think of them as just paying the working class a bribe. The period from 1930 to 1970, they had to pay off the population to get them to stop talking about socialism, about getting a new system. And now, with the collapse of the Soviet Union and with a lot of repression, things like COINTELPRO, the McCarthyism and all that stuff, and you know, now that that threat is gone, we're actually seeing the mask come off of both parties. We're seeing the mask come off of capitalism. And it's the system. That's the source of the evil. It's not that we have good or bad people within that system. It's just
right.
That system inherently generates a race to the bottom in terms of wages and benefits and an imperialist foreign policy. So I think that's where we need to go in the conversation. And if we really want to change things, we need to go back to a class-conscious socialist movement that's going to create a culture of class consciousness that sees that it's the system. We can't try to reform. We can't you know, capitalism can I believe in market abolitionism. There's an editor at Z Magazine named Michael Albert. He has this great phrase, market abolitionism. It's a new abolitionist movement to eliminate the capitalist system out of our lives 100%.
So if we did that, what would we replace it with, Sean?
Socialism. I've talked about this with you before, Adam. I don't think socialism ever really had a fair shake. You look at China and the Soviet Union. They tried to go from a feudal monarchy all the way to socialism, and they had to go through forced industrialization and basically skip an entire stage of economic development. I think socialism can work, as Marx wrote about, but it has to evolve out of a capitalist system like the one we have now. Capitalism inherently produces crisis after crisis, and we've reached late stage capitalism, and now it's time to evolve into socialism. And eliminate profit 100%.
Well, if you look at what Marx talked about, we're right on schedule, right? I mean, he said that the problems that we are seeing in this capitalist system are built into the DNA of capitalism, that this concentration of money and power and corruption is inevitable, and that it will lead to a socialist system.
It's basically a capitalist counterattack. You know, they paid their bribe, they repressed people, they murdered Black Panthers, they imprisoned Black Panthers, they lobotomized us of our class consciousness over that period of time. And now it's a counteroffensive. Let's roll back all the concessions we had to make. They resent the fact that they ever had to give any concessions at all in the first place. And by God, they intend to get every concession back, not only in the United States, but all across Western Europe. That's this whole austerity movement is all about smashing the working class, smashing regular people, and putting them back in place where the capitalists believe we belong.
Well, Sean, I do appreciate the call. Appreciate it. So do you agree with Sean? That we just need to replace capitalism entirely. Sometimes I go back and forth on that. I do think that we need to look beyond our political system and look fundamentally at the economic system, because it is the economic system that has corrupted our political system. They are now kind of fused together. 1-888-321-6001. Do we replace this whole system? I mean, is capitalism working perfectly? Is this is what it's supposed to do, to kind of corrupt the working class, to concentrate wealth and power at the expense of everything else? And do we need to, at this point, as we begin to think about paradigm shifts, a complete shift away from capitalism entirely? I am not smart enough to answer that question, but I can ask it. Let's go to Don in Oregon. Don, you're on the...
Hey, good afternoon, Adam. How you doing?
I'm all right, Don. How are you doing?
Doing great. Oh, the latest in the news is apparently John Boehner finally caved and agreed to the 2-month extension.
Right. I saw that. I'm a little bit confused. I've read about 4 articles on it, and I'm a little bit confused. As I understand, what they wanted to do is they wanted this 2-month extension because they want to negotiate different terms for a year-long extension,
and they knew
if they didn't get the 2-month extension, they wouldn't get anything. Is that correct?
That's pretty much it, I think.
But isn't that just exactly what we're talking about, that these tiny little victories, what am I supposed to do, get out in the street and celebrate that when everything is going down the toilet? This is what drives me nuts.
I know.
This is what drives me nuts.
Probably way too late, chances are.
I like it when we win victories, but we need big victories. We need a vision.
Tiny ones.
We need a vision. Don, thanks for the call.
You're
I do appreciate
welcome.
It. You know, the old statement that without vision, the people perish. Without vision, the people perish. That's what I need. That's why I rewrote the speech. I want a vision of this country. That was what I thought President Obama was giving us. This is what I want to see him resurrect, not just as a campaigner, not just as a candidate for president, but as a human being taking a stand in history. I'm Adam Klugman, in for Norman Goldman. More of your calls are next. 1-888-321-6001 are the numbers. 1-888-321-6001. This is the Norman Goldman Show, where justice is served. We'll be right back.
Not gonna do it. Can't wish you happy holidays. Just kidding. Gotta do the Christian thing. Bar and I say drill, baby, drill. Nope. Happy holidays. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year.
This is the Norman Goldman Show.
Welcome back to the Norman Goldman Show. I'm Adam Klugman, sitting in for Norman Goldman. This is the place where justice is served and where fierce independence is the norm. I always say it, but I love those slogans, and I kind of like running them together. I think they work kind of conjoined beautifully. Let's go to calls right away. Let's go to Cindy in Chicago. Welcome to the Norman Goldman Show. You're on with Adam Klugman.
Hey.
Hey.
I have never been more compelled to pick up the phone and call the radio, and I don't do it. I listen all the time, but what you just said was what everybody in this world needs to hear, because that is the basis of what has to happen and be the change for this country. It's not a, I'm going to get emotional, but it's not about this other crap. It's
right.
Give the president the backing and the words to say what needs to be said to the people of this country, which is what you just said. I'm so proud of you.
Cindy, thank you very much.
You wrote it. You wrote the speech.
I wrote the speech because I get frustrated with the minutiae.
I am too. And I have been so frustrated for so long. And you said what I have felt for so long. I had to call you.
Oh,
I mean,
Cindy.
It is absolutely what needs to change in this country. We need to go back to where our parents and our grandparents were. It's all about caring about this country and everybody in this country.
Right. It's about building a society that works for everyone. I say this a lot.
And
we're either building a society that works for everyone, or we're building a doomed one.
It is totally correct, and it's what has been lost in our country, and you know, we've forgotten all of those values, and, you know, I know that they're there for, you know, probably 85% of us, but everybody's afraid to say those things.
And it's the president. And Cindy, thanks for the call. I really do appreciate it. I want to get some other callers, but thank you so much, and I'm glad that you were moved by the call. That really makes me feel great.
It's very important that people hear those kinds of words. And not said in a mean or demonstrative way. It's all about those values, and that's what's going to restore this country, is if people start thinking backwards and thinking about what made it be the way it was and why it got where it was and what made it strong. And I believe that we can do that. I still have hope.
I still have hope, but we got to speak it out loud. Thank you, Cindy, for the call. I appreciate it. We've got to scream it from the rooftops. And if somebody gives me a microphone, I'm going to scream it from the tallest rooftop I can find. And so thank you, Norman Goldman, for giving me this opportunity. Let's go to Tom in Chicago. You're on the Norman Goldman Show with Adam Klugman. What's up, Tom?
Adam Klugman, what's going on, man?
Well, I don't know, man. What's going on with you? I'm fired up today.
I just want to let you know I've been listening to Norm for a good while on the way to work.
Good for you.
Every day. I've never heard of you. I'm sorry. But yesterday when I was listening to you, your intro was amazing.
Thank you.
Oh, my God. That rant was like a George Carlin rant. It was amazing.
Thank you.
Stop for that real quick.
Thanks.
But I also have a question for you. Have you ever heard of the Zeitgeist Movement?
Yes, I have, and I've seen the movies.
Awesome.
For those of you who haven't heard of it, go to YouTube and type in the word Zeitgeist, Z-E-I-T-G-E-I-S-T. Did I spell it right?
Oh, you did. And I real quick, I called the – I'm calling from Progressive Talk 820, and I tried calling one guy late night, you know, tried letting him know about Zeitgeist, asked him what his opinion was. He's like, just blew me off. I was just like, all right, whatever. But I just wanted to know, what's your opinion on the movement? I mean, what's your opinion?
I what I know of the movement, I know more through the information coming in through the movies. There's a whole series of them. And for people who don't know what Zeitgeist means, it's kind of the cultural
It's German for spirit of the time.
Spirit of the time. So it's kind of it's often used to mean whatever is kind of going on culturally that we all buy into and accept without
socially,
question.
Economically, right. Correct.
Tell me about the movement. I mean, beyond the movies, tell me what the movement's up to.
Well, I'm not really part of that culture per se. Me and my friends, we spread as much information as we can, via computer, but I'm not like one of those subscribe guys or whatever. I just kind of spread the word from word of mouth. But, you keep talking about change and what are we going to do and the system's wrong and everything like that, and I totally agree with you. And for those people who don't know what Zeitgeist is, watch the movies. They will show you part by part what is wrong with the system and how institutions, have been corrupt to control the masses. And
I think the most lucid part of it, and thanks for the call, Tom, I appreciate it. I think the most lucid part of the Zeitgeist movies is the stuff that they've done on the Fed. It's real eye-opening stuff, man, what they've done on the Fed, and it really hit me up. I still want to explore it. I think I'm going to do a show on it to really understand how our financial system works. Yikes, the way we borrow money to print money and we pay interest to a private bank, it's crazy. Let's go to Rebecca, line two. Rebecca in Seattle, you're on the Norman Goldman Show with Adam Klugman. What's up, Rebecca?
Hi, Adam.
Hi.
I love what you're saying.
Thank you.
It's about time somebody started saying this stuff.
You're right.
I mean, I was aware of this when I was 17 years old in 1981. I looked at my dad when I heard Ronald Reagan got elected. I went, Dad, we're screwed. He went, yeah, you're right. And he was a union member all his life. I was a union member for 15 years. I was part of the longest, largest strike in Puget Sound history in 1989, we stood up and we fought. And you know what? People need to stand up and fight.
Yes, they do.
And people like you give us a voice, and I appreciate everything that you say and what Norm says. And you know what? It's about time. It's about time. The revolution is coming, man.
It is coming, and we're going to not carry water for anybody but the people of this country.
You know it.
And that's it. And Rebecca, stay strong, stay human, stay creative, stay mad as hell. And we will change the direction of this country. As long as they keep giving me a microphone, I'll keep trying to speak the truth to the best of my ability. I really appreciate it. I'm going to move on. Let's go to Sadie in Michigan. Welcome to the Norman Goldman Show. You're on with Adam Klugman.
Yeah, how you doing, Ed?
I'm doing pretty well. How are you?
I'm good. I came to this country since 86. I left my country because of all the Bush. I'm from Lebanon. But this is not what I'm mad about. I'm mad you're just saying we're supposed to say the truth. The truth is, we went to Iraq to, we sent our soldiers to die for who? For Bush and his people. Because they want the oil to make more money. If they want that oil so bad, why don't you get the hell out of this country and leave our country? Because I defend this as my country since I've been here since 86. I'm an American citizen. I'm sick and tired from Bush and his people, sending all our people to Iraq and Afghanistan. They're dying for what? For him and his people? We're sick and tired. Why don't you ask, leave us alone, leave our President Barack Obama alone, let him work. And let him do the right thing for this country.
Well, Sadie, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. I'm not entirely sure. I didn't understand it. There was a lot of background noise. I don't know if he was telling me to leave Barack Obama alone or if he was saying leave our country alone for oil. I could barely understand what he was saying. But, Sadie, I do appreciate the call. Let's go to Janet in Chicago in the little time we have left. Janet, welcome.
Hi, Adam.
Hi.
You're talking to a socialist.
Talking to a socialist, okay.
Barack Obama was a socialist, and I said, no, he's not. If he was a socialist, I would like it much better.
Me too.
I started out as an FDR Democrat, a classic FDR Democrat, and my son pulled me to the left. And we've had many discussions about whether or not it will be evolution or revolution. And I voted for a Democrat my entire life. I voted for Jimmy Carter the first time. and I voted for Democrats every single time. I believed in voting. And the last time I voted, I cried because Barack Obama won. And since he won, I'm with my son now. It's not going to be evolution.
But keep voting.
They won't let go of it. It'll be a revolution.
But we got to keep voting anyway. While we're working on the revolution, we also have to work to keep voting.
Well,
we mustn't
give
up.
I don't believe it will work anymore. I'll be there.
But do it anyway. We'll do it anyway because we got to keep hope alive. I appreciate the call, Janet. Thank you very much.
Bye.
So I want to, in this little bit that we have left, just let people know what's going on in the next hour or two. I have a guest, Jeremy Rifkin is his name. You might want to, at the break, check him out at thirdindustrialrevolution.com or FOET.org, FOET.org. We are going to have a discussion about how we get from here to where we need to go in the most practical terms. This is a man who nobody in America, very few people in America have heard of, but all over Europe is respected as somebody who is beyond just a thinker. He is somebody who is designing the systems that will take us into the future to become a post-carbon society, a post-carbon civilization. This is the Norman Goldman Show, the place where justice is served. I'm Adam Klugman, and we'll be right back after this.
Now, another hour of Smart Talk, 620 KPOJ, Portland's Talk.
From the streets of New York to the hills of Los Angeles, a voice is rising to serve justice. This is the Norman Goldman Show, the home of fierce independence, intelligent dialogue, and passionate logic is right here, right now. Sitting in for Norm, here is Adam Klugman, host of Mad as Hell in America Radio. Heard Saturdays on AM 620, Portland's Talk, KPOJ.
Welcome back to the Norman Goldman Show. I'm Adam Klugman in for Norman Goldman this holiday season. And this is the place where justice is served and where fierce independence is the norm. So I want you to relax. I want you to get comfortable. We are going to have a very long conversation with somebody. I started out this week saying that what I'm after is a paradigm shift, a shift away from the political minutiae of the day, the little squabbles and skirmishes that we have each and every day that I believe keep us distracted in this country from the conversation we need to have about how we are going to get from the crisis we are in now to where we need to go, to a post-carbon civilization, and even beyond that. And to help us understand how to do that is our next guest. He is going to be with us for 2 hours, and we are going to be having a discussion, but I want to let everybody know that we are not having this conversation at you. We are having this conversation with you, and so we want your calls and your questions. My guest's name is Jeremy Rifkin, and he has informed me that he wants calls. We want to be having this conversation together. It is not us on the stage and you in the audience. This is a conversation we are convening with each other. So get out your pencils. 1-888-321-6001 are the numbers. I'm going to read Jeremy Rifkin's bio, and then I'm going to invite him on. It's a pretty hefty bio. Jeremy Rifkin is president of the Foundation on Economic Trends. The website is FOET.org, FOET.org. He is the best-selling author of 19 books on the impact of scientific and technological changes on the economy, the workforce, society, and the environment. His books have been translated into more than 35 languages and are used in hundreds of universities, corporations, and government agencies around the world. His most recent books include The Empathic Civilization, which we will be discussing in the third hour, The Hydrogen Economy, The European Dream, The End of Work, The Age of Access, The Biotech Century, and the book we will be discussing right now, The Third Industrial Revolution. I must go on. Jeremy Rifkin has been an advisor to the European Union for the past decade. Mr. Rifkin advised the government of Spain during its presidency of the European Union. Mr. Rifkin also served as an advisor to President Nicolas Sarkozy of France, Chancellor Angela Merkel of Germany, Prime Minister José Socrates of Portugal, and Prime Minister Janez Janša of Slovenia. He currently advises the European Commission, the European Parliament, and several EU heads of states, including Chancellor Angela Merkel of Germany and Prime Minister Jose Luis Rodriguez. Jeremy Rifkin, welcome to the Norman Goldman Show. It is an honor to have you here.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you this evening.
This is an interview that I've wanted to conduct for a long time, ever since I discovered your work. I know that you are very well known in Europe, not so much here, and I want to get into that in a little bit about why and how that has happened. But first, is there anything in your background I left out that you think listeners need to know as a headliner for our conversation today?
Well, I think the only other thing is that I do teach. I teach at the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania. And I've been there a very long time in the executive education program.
And the executive education program is where you call in lots of different CEOs from all over the country to kind of talk them through this third industrial revolution concept. Do I have
it
right?
Yes, that's correct. And all over the world. Our companies come from every country.
So we're going to be having a long conversation today, so I want us to kind of relax into it a little bit. And again, I want to give out the phone numbers. This is a conversation we're having with you, not at you. 1-888-321-6001. You're here to discuss the third industrial revolution, but I want to start with the imperative for why we need one. And I don't think that this is a matter of making out some apocalyptic prophecy, but actually coming out of denial about we're rarely where we are in terms of climate change and the crisis that we face, not just in this country, but on the planet. So why don't we go through an assessment of that? Let's start with where we are and where the imperative for a third industrial revolution comes from.
Right now, we are at, I think, a seminal turning point, not only for the economy and our civilization, but really for our species. I don't think there's any other period in history quite like the one that we're now experiencing. We've had two seminal events in the last 3 years. By the way, can you hear me? I'm getting an echo from this end.
I hear you pretty well.
Okay. All right. Maybe they can fix that echo on this end, though.
Maybe at the break we'll try recalling.
We've had two events in the last 3 years, which I think are a turning point for our civilization. The first event was July 2008. If you recall that month, oil prices hit $147 a barrel that month on world markets. It was a record.
Right.
And when that happened, all the other prices for everything we buy went through the roof. And the reason that's the case is that everything in this civilization is either made by or moved by fossil fuels. Petrochemical fertilizers and pesticides for growing our food. Almost all of our pharmaceutical products are petrochemical. Virtually all of our construction materials, from plastic to cements, are made out of fossil fuels. Our synthetic fiber, our power, transport, heat, and light. So when oil started to go over about $80 a barrel in 2007, all the other prices went up. And I think if you remember, when oil hit $120 a barrel, food prices went up for basic commodities like rice and wheat and barley and rye. And those prices were doubling and tripling. And, you know, 40% of the human race lives on $2 a day or less. So when those food prices started going up, the UN put out an alert saying we have 1 billion people now on the verge of deep hunger. At $147 a barrel, the prices for everything we buy were so prohibitive that Americans and everyone else just stopped buying. And in July of 2008, purchasing power plummeted. The global economy shut down. And what I'm suggesting here is that that was the great economic earthquake that signaled the beginning of an end game for the industrial revolution based on fossil fuels. That was the earthquake. The collapse of the financial market 60 days later, that was the aftershock. We're still dealing with the aftershock. We haven't gotten to the earthquake. And the reason this is an end game is that we've hit two milestones, peak oil per capita and global peak oil production. Peak oil per capita occurred back in 1979, at the height of the auto age, and we distributed all the oil we had at that point to everyone alive at that moment. That's the most each person could have if we shared the oil. We found more oil in 30 years, but population rose a lot quicker. So if we shared all the oil we have now with 7 billion people, there's less to go around. So that's peak oil per capita. Then peak oil production. Now, that's a controversial geological term. It's when half the oil reserves in the world are used up. When half the oil reserves are used up, it becomes unaffordable. You just can't afford the price for the second half. And, you know, the optimist said, well, maybe we'll peak around 2030. And the pessimist among the geologists said, no, it's going to be much earlier. Well, last December, the International Energy Agency, which is the authoritative body on energy that we all rely on, they dropped a bombshell. In their 2011 report, they said it looks like the world peaked on crude oil in 2006 at 70 million barrels a day and will plateau down to maybe 69 million barrels a day for the next 20 years. But listen to this. It'll cost $8 trillion to get the remaining oil out. So what's happened here is when China and India made a bid to bring a third of the human race into the second industrial revolution at a 9, 10, 11% growth rate in the last 10 years, just too much aggregate demand against supply of oil. So what I'm suggesting here is that every time we try to regrow the economy at the same rate we were growing before July 2008, oil prices go up, all the other prices for everything else goes up, purchasing power goes down, and we shut it off. That's what's happening tonight. Oil prices have shot up in the last year since we've tried to replenish inventory and start the engine, and now purchasing power is declining because the prices are too high, and we're going to a second collapse. So these are going to be four-year intervals of growth, collapse for the next 20 years. It's an end game. It's a very dangerous moment, but it's also a moment of opportunity. That's the first major issue. The second issue is climate change, the entropy bill for the industrial age. You know, we spewed massive amounts of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere in the first and second industrial revolutions, 19th and 20th century, and now we just have too much CO2 in that atmosphere, and we just can't get enough of the heat, the sun's heat, off the planet. And you remember that our world leaders met in Copenhagen in December 2009 to address this issue. And despite the fact that our scientists tell us that climate change is the decisive event in the history of our species and that we face potential widespread losses on this planet of human life and animal life, plant life, our heads of state could not cut a deal. The talks collapsed, and now the most recent talks in Durban collapsed. And I'd just like to add one more thing about why this climate change is so potentially terrifying. Our scientists tell us, and the UN panel on climate change, and it's 2,500 scientists, all the national academies, that we're probably going to go up 3 degrees Celsius in this century. Now, that's looking optimistic. This was the report from 2007. But to give your listeners a perspective here, if we go up 3 degrees, which doesn't sound so bad, that takes us back to the temperature on this little planet 3 million years ago in the Pliocene era, completely different ecosystems. And what climate change is really all about is the radical shift in the water cycle, the hydrological cycle of the Earth, in a short moment of time. For every 1 degree that the temperature of the Earth rises, the atmosphere absorbs 7% more precipitation from the ground. It just sucks up that precipitation. So that means more floods, more droughts, more tsunamis, more hurricanes, more glacier melts. The entire water cycle of the planet shifts because the atmosphere is absorbing so much more precipitation, and our ecosystems can't catch up to that shift in the water cycle, and they destabilize. And then the species of plant and animal life in those ecosystems die out. The bottom line, our scientists say that it looks like we are on the early stages of the sixth great extinction event in history. We've had five in the last 500 million years, five wipeouts, where we lost most of the plant and animal species. And each time we had a mass extinction event, it comes quickly when the chemistry of the planet shifts. And when that happens, it takes approximately 10 million years to recover the biodiversity we lost. So our scientists are saying today it looks like we may see upwards of 70% die out. That's on the upper end of our fellow species by the end of the century if we don't make some radical change. So as my wife says, I think we're sleepwalking here. These events, though, are a wake-up call that we need to rethink our civilization. We need a new economic narrative that's compelling. We need a new economic vision that can get us off carbon. It has to be deliverable within 30 years. It has to create hundreds of millions of jobs and new businesses. And it has to get us to a sustainable world. And that's a big, big task. Daunting.
Our guest is Jeremy Rifkin. You can learn more about him. He's author of many books. One of them is The Third Industrial Revolution. You can go to thirdindustrialrevolution.com to learn more about what he's talking about. We haven't even gotten to what the Third Industrial Revolution is because we're still talking about the imperative that we need to wake up in this country. It isn't about doom and gloom. It's about waking up and facing the truth. If we don't have, it's where I started in the first hour. If we're not willing to look at the truth, we cannot succeed in fixing the problems of our world. But it is still possible. When we come back, Jeremy Rifkin, I want to ask you what you say to people who say this is all just about a seasonal change in the earth. But first, we need to go to a break, and we'll be back. The number's here, 1-888-321-6001. Again, this is not a conversation we're having at you. We need to have this conversation with you. What are your feelings about climate change? What do you know? What do you believe? You're listening to the Norman Goldman Show with our guest, Jeremy Rifkin. We'll be right back. This is the place where fierce independence is the norm.
See, we can't let the terrorists win. That's why you have to have a really good Christian happy holiday season. Because I've been misunderestimated. So happy holidays. And come on down to the George W. Bush Library. We'll have some coloring books for you. And some crayons, too. We'll see you in 2011. Bring money. We need money, too.
This is the Norman Goldman Show.
Welcome back to the Norman Goldman Show. I'm Adam Klugman, sitting in for Norman Goldman. This is the place where fierce independence is the norm, and our guest is Jeremy Rifkin. He is president of the Foundation on Economic Trends. The website is FOET, FOET.org. He is the author of many books translated into 35 languages. The book we are discussing today for this hour and the next is The Third Industrial Revolution. You can learn more about that at thirdindustrialrevolution.com. Jeremy Rifkin, welcome back to the Norman Goldman Show.
Thank you.
So we have been, is the echo better? Are you here?
Yes, no, it's fine now.
Okay, good. So we were discussing the imperative. In a moment, we're going to move on to discussing the Third Industrial Revolution and what that really looks like and how we get there from here. But we were still discussing the imperative. And this isn't about trying to frighten people, only in so much as it is to frighten them awake to accept what is really going on. So what do you say to people who say, well, this is all just a seasonal change in the Earth's atmosphere. This isn't human-made. This is perfectly natural. How do you respond to people? And I'm sure you get that.
Yeah, we do. I don't get it in Europe and other parts of the world, certainly here in the United States, because I think in most of the world there's an acceptance of the science of this. But, you know, the scientific record is not a matter of opinion in some areas. Let me give you what I mean in terms of the statistics. The amount of carbon in the atmosphere has never exceeded 300 parts per million in the last 670,000 years. Now, remember, anatomically modern humans have only been here about 175,000 years. They're the youngest species on the planet. But the CO2 levels have never gone over 300 parts per million in the last 670,000 years. As the industrial age began to move with full steam, the carbon content went up, and now it's 370 parts per million, and we're heading to 450 parts per million. So that's just a reality. That's in the record. Methane levels and nitrous oxide levels, same thing. The levels have gone up dramatically in the first and second industrial revolutions. And if you think about it as seasonal, it's not seasonal when we begin to see open waters in the Arctic every summer. The last four summers, we've had open waters. You can kayak in the Arctic. But the Arctic hasn't seen open waters for hundreds of thousands of years. That's not seasonal by any stretch of the imagination. Now, there's no doubt that you can't blame every rainstorm or every hurricane on climate change. But if you look at the statistics year in and year out and just experience the change, it's very obvious that the planet is warming and that it's affecting a large swath of our ecosystems around the world. And it's a shame that in the last few years in America there's been a disinformation campaign by a very, very small minority, very few scientists, however, to discredit climate change. All I would ask the listeners to do is Google up all the climate reports from all the great centers in the world, the National Academies of Science in every country, the great universities around the world. They can't all be engaged in a massive conspiracy to hoodwink the citizens of the planet. But people should do their own homework. Google up climate change. Look at the studies.
Yes, do your own homework. I think it's time that we accepted this. Our guest is Jeremy Rifkin. We're about to go to another break. They come up awful fast, but we have a long time. Jeremy Rifkin's going to be here with us. You're listening to the Norman Goldman Show. The Place Where Justice Is Served. We'll be right back.
620 KPOJ, Portland's talk, and available everywhere on iHeartRadio.
Welcome back to the Norman Goldman Show. I'm Adam Klugman, sitting in for Norman Goldman, the place where fierce independence is the norm. Our guest is Jeremy Rifkin, author of The Third Industrial Revolution. You can learn more at thirdindustrialrevolution.com. He is president of the Foundation on Economic He's president of the Foundation on Economic Trends. That's FOET.org. He is the best-selling author of 19 books that have been translated into more than 35 languages. And the book we are discussing today is, as I said, The Third Industrial Revolution. Jeremy Rifkin has been an advisor to the European Union for the past decade, and he is the principal architect of something called the European Union's Third Industrial Revolution Long-Term Economic Sustainability Plan to address the triple challenge of global economic crisis. I'm having trouble talking. Energy security and climate change. Jeremy Rifkin, welcome back to the Norman Goldman Show.
Thank you.
So I want to talk a little bit about feedback loops. You once wrote a seminal book on climate change, and you laid out some predictions that turned out actually to be wrong because they didn't account for something called feedback loops. What is a feedback loop in the context of global climate change?
Well, let me say I underestimated, although I've been engaged in this discussion since 1980 when I wrote a book called Entropy. I think the first popular book on climate change. But in all the years, while I knew that climate change was dramatically affecting our lives, I underestimated the speed of climate change because I couldn't wrap my mind intellectually around the subtleties of the feedback loops in this very, very complicated earth we live in. I'll give you an example of a feedback loop that's happening right now. We're watching with very, very carefully the Siberian subcontinent off Antarctica. The Siberian subcontinent's about the size of France and Germany. And the ground in that area is all covered by permafrost. Underneath that permafrost is a ticking time bomb. And that's all the carbon deposits from a previous period in history. That area up there used to be a lush grassland before the last ice age, full of teeming with animal and plant life. When the ice age came, it came quick. And all that carbon deposit was buried underneath the permafrost and trapped there. Now, in the last UN climate panel report, they mentioned permafrost, but there were no studies. Now the studies have come in, and it's really troubling because we're seeing the permafrost is melting for the first time in 125,000 years, and the carbon is coming up. And near the water, near the lakes, it's coming up as methane, which is 23 times more potent than carbon dioxide. There's more carbon underneath the ground there than all the rainforests in the world. Now, here's the feedback loop. As the ice melts on the permafrost, it releases more carbon. But remember, the ice reflects heat, all right? And so it helps get the heat off the planet. But when the ice melts and it turns black, there's no ice reflecting the heat off, but rather the ground is absorbing that and the atmosphere. That's a feedback loop. So these are the kinds of things that we had not anticipated early on 25 years ago. But now those feedback loops, what they do is they accelerate the process of change, and they trigger other changes, and then other changes, and then other changes in a cascading set of events.
And accelerate the whole process in ways that we couldn't have imagined.
That's right.
Our guest is Jeremy Rifkin, author of the book Third Industrial Revolution. The thirdindustrialrevolution.com is the website. You can also learn more about his organization, Foundation on Economic Trends, at FOET.org. We have some calls on the board, Jeremy, so I'd like to take them. Let's go to Chris in San Francisco. You're on with Jeremy Rifkin. Welcome to the Norman Goldman Show.
It's great that you have your guest, Mr. Rifkin. I'm a great admirer. I don't have 19 of your books, but I do have 3 of them.
That's a good start.
Yes, it is. It is an excellent start. One of the things that I wondered, it's just slightly tangential to the explanation that you're doing here, but because I'm a scientist and I have a total belief in all of this. So, but what I'd like to ask you really is, I get the impression from reading many of your books of that that you believe, and since you're in touch with world leaders and so forth, that world leaders and CEOs of big corporations are going to eventually buy off on some kind of solution, and that they're going to pitch in and somehow, I've worked for big companies before, and somehow they're going to change their ways, and they're going to pitch in and come to a solution. And I guess it's because I'm an American, and I look at it from the U.S. side of it. I know the Europeans are far ahead of this, but I don't see that. I mean, I don't see our government and our CEOs actually turning the corner on this as a total group in order to make a change in time to do anything substantial, at least from the U.S. And I think we need to do it from the bottom up. I've been involved in worker-owned, worker-managed companies for several years. And so I'm just wondering, what's your position on that idea?
I think it has to come from the bottom up. And, of course, that's what's happened in Europe, that there's a much deeper sense of ecological responsibility across the European landscape among the broad population in Europe. We used to be at the forefront of ecological sensitivity in this country, and certainly there's a large segment of the American population that still is. But Europe is very, very committed. So there's been pressure from the bottom up on political parties, on government, and it's paid off. The European Union is engaging in this transition out of carbon into a third industrial revolution, which I think we'll get to in the next segment.
Yes.
And Germany is leading this revolution. That's no small item. I've been advising Germany and the Chancellor Merkel since she came in informally. And Germany's the powerhouse. We need to understand that Germany is the most robust industrial economy per capita in the world, with 80 million people, far ahead of the United States. And it's the leading exporting power in the world, along with China, even though there's only 80 million people. So I think we should be very careful and look at what Germany's doing here. Big companies, middle-sized companies, small companies, homeowners, cooperatives, they're moving into all the five pillars of this third industrial revolution, which we'll get to shortly. It's true that in Europe, the business community, the civil society, and especially local and regional government are very, very busy moving this agenda along to get us off carbon. We're seeing less so here, although I would say that California, Oregon, and Washington State in the West, and certainly some states in the Northeast, Vermont and Massachusetts, are moving ahead. Southern Texas, interesting enough, from San Antonio to Austin. So there are pockets across the United States where local business, local government, and local civil society are absolutely moving ahead, and their agenda is much closer to the European agenda, whereas the federal government in Washington and the large corporate lobbies, especially the energy industry, are hell-bent on keeping the status quo. The problem is it's going to turn America into a society that will not have an economic future. And I'll share this anecdote with you. When the Chancellor Merkel became Chancellor of Germany, she asked me to come there in the first few weeks to help her government address the question, how do you grow the German economy in the 21st century? And when I got to Berlin, the first thing I asked the Chancellor is, Madam Chancellor, how do you grow the German economy or the European Union economy or the world economy in the last stages of a great energy era? And what I think Americans have to understand is that our current energy regime, coal, oil, gas, shale gas, tar sands, these are sunset energies. The prices are going up, up, up. So the costs are never going down again. And they're dirty, and they emit CO2, and they take us to more climate change, which affects our agriculture and our infrastructure. And the technologies based on those energies, like the internal combustion engine, are old. They've exhausted their S-curve. There's just no multiplier effect. And the whole infrastructure of this country is made out of carbon, all of our construction materials, and it's crumbling. So how do you grow an American economy in an old second industrial revolution energy, technology, and infrastructure? So I think what we have to ask in this country is, where do we want to be in 20 years from now? The question Europe's asked is, do they want to be in the sunset energies, the sunset industries and technologies of the 20th century, or the sunrise energies, industries, and technologies of a third industrial revolution in the 21st century? And Europe, and especially Germany and the Scandinavian countries, are saying we want to head to the future. America has yet to have that debate in Washington, although I think at the state and regional level in parts of the country, that debate is well along.
And I'm hoping that I'm hoping that what we're doing here is hoping to move that conversation along. This conversation has been well underway for over 10 years in Europe, and it seems to me that this country is lagging behind for a lot of unnecessary political reasons that are not just hampering us economically, but have long-term environmental implications as well. Jeremy, I want to go to another call before we go to break. Let's go to Glenn in Washington. Glenn, you're on with Jeremy Rifkin.
And also you. And I am so honored to get this opportunity. All of what has been discussed, your speech earlier was a speech that I would want to convey myself, and at some point that might actually happen. And the carbon question, I'm a farmer out here, and I've been an organic farmer for the last 25 years, working on carbon sequestration in my soils. And it seems to me, having been in farming for 40 years plus, and experiencing most of the, and lived in Germany and experienced their forward thinking back in the 70s, and especially in agriculture and silviculture and carbon management. And I've gotten kind of a head start in this part of the world, discussing it as a political, economic driving opportunity for our future, to learn how to compost such that we have energy creation in hot water. Mm-hmm. I've been pushing this concept for 25 years, and it's just now starting to get to be an economic threshold where such conversation gets a little bit more time than it used to. But being able to employ millions of people in the forest of the country to manage the carbon into good compost to recarbonize our soils is of an utmost important thing for our long-term food security and our economic security, because that's our best economic income.
Glenn, thanks so much for the call. I'm going to let Jeremy take a quick shot at that before we go to break. Jeremy, that kind of brings us to what we're going to be talking about in the next segment and the rest of the show, which is, you know, there are great ideas out there for how we kind of re-engineer our society. Do you want to take a quick response to Glenn?
Well, I agree. In the book, in the Third Industrial Revolution book, we have some details on agriculture and what has to be done. And like the listener and the caller, we have to move to a much more ecologically sound organic-based agriculture. We have to reduce the petrochemical energy inputs. It's absurd for farmers to have to pay for very expensive petrochemical fertilizers and pesticides, and the energy costs are just going through the roof, and to engage in practices that actually make it more expensive for our food to be processed, and we also process food that's more unhealthy and just not good for us or the environment. So I think farmers, there are farmers at the cutting edge here in the United States, certainly across Europe, who are moving to ecological-based organic farming in a very, very big way. And, of course, a lot of Americans are getting on board. You know, my wife and I shop at Whole Foods. We were just there for our shopping for the Christmas season. And here's an industry, organic food and farming, that's the fastest-growing sector of the food industry. So I think there's some hope.
I do, too, and I think at the level of food, we do get it here in this country. But I think we're having trouble waking up from the carbon dream, so to speak, that we still think that we have time, when in fact we really don't. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Jeremy Rifkin about what really the third industrial revolution would look like, not just in this country, but on the planet, and how we move to a post-carbon civilization. Our guest is Jeremy Rifkin. He is president of the Foundation on Economic Trends. FOET.org is the website. You can also learn more about his book at thirdindustrialrevolution.com. You're listening to the Norman Goldman Show. I'm Adam Klugman, in for Norman Goldman. This is the place where justice is served. We'll be right back with Jeremy Rifkin and the Third Industrial Revolution.
We here at the Norman Goldman Show hope that this holiday season finds you employed and where you want to be in your life. Happy holidays from all of us here at the Norman Goldman Show.
This is the place where justice is served. Our guest is Jeremy Rifkin. He is president of the Foundation on Economic Trends and the best-selling author of 19 books translated into over 35 languages on the impact of the scientific and technological changes of the economy, the workforce, society, and the environment. Mr. Rifkin is principal architect of the European Union's Third Industrial Revolution Long-Term Economic Sustainability Plan to address the triple challenge of global economic crisis, energy security, and climate change. Mr. Rifkin, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
So I think we've done a pretty good job of outlining the problem and the imperative for waking up from the carbon dream, where as Europe kind of got this over a decade ago. But we're going to go into a long break in a minute. But let's outline what you mean when you talk about a third industrial revolution. Let's try to encapsulate it.
Well, you know, the great economic revolutions in history occur when new energy regimes emerge and then converge with new communication revolutions to manage them. So when communication energy revolutions come together, they really change economic history. We're on the cusp right now of a new communication energy convergence, and it's moving quickly in Germany and parts of Europe. The Internet, this powerful communication tool in the last 20 years, which is distinguished because it's distributed and collaborative, and allows 2 billion people to share knowledge and information with each other in a lateral form of power that's much more powerful than the most centralized television networks of the 20th century. This Internet revolution is now converging with a new energy regime, distributed renewable energy. And when the Internet begins to manage these distributed renewable energies, we have a powerful economic paradigm shift. So in this, what we need to imagine in America, and this is what's happening in Europe, millions and millions and millions of buildings, homes, offices, factories converted to your own green micro power plant. So you can collect solar energy off the roof, wind off the walls, geothermal energy underneath the building, and you have your own power plant like you have your own computer. Then we establish an energy internet. We transform the transmission and utility lines of the United States so that millions of people can create their own green electricity on site, and any extra they have, they can share it across an energy internet from San Francisco to New York, just like we create our own information now in our computers, share it online. Germany is now moving into this new convergence of energy and communication and establishing an energy internet across the country, and it's created hundreds of thousands of jobs and thousands of new businesses in the last 4 years. We should be looking to what they're doing there.
It's one of the frustrating things, because I felt that this was the conversation that we were going to be having when President Obama came in as the next president. That this is where, you know, people get on me for bashing him, but I feel that this was the conversation that I was hoping that we were going to start into early in 2008 about how we really re-engineer our society to gear it toward our own survival, and just towards the implementation of better ideas. There are better ideas out there than oil, coal, and tar sands. And there are ways for us to be generating energy right where we are. And I want to get into that when we come back. These breaks could be difficult, but you create a distinction between what you call elite energies and distributive energies. And you just gave us an example of how we might take advantage of distributive energies. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit about that, but give us a quick definition of what you mean by elite energies.
Elite energies are energies that aren't found in your backyard. Coal, oil, shale gas, tar sands. They're only found in a few places. By and large, they require large military and geopolitical investments to secure them and massive capital to manage them. Distributed energies are found in every square inch of the world and found in your backyard. The sun shines all over the world every day. The wind blows across the planet every day. We have a geothermal heat underneath the ground wherever we tread. In the rural areas, we have agricultural and forestry waste that can be converted overnight to energy. On the coastal areas, the ocean tides and waves are a source of energy 24 hours a day. We have enough of this distributed energy on every inch of this planet to provide for our species until kingdom comes. The key is how to marshal it, organize it, and create a new infrastructure for a new third industrial revolution paradigm to bring it online really quickly. Obama's mistake? He didn't have the overview. He didn't have the narrative. So he piecemealed all of these programs with sidled little projects around the country and spent billions of our dollars, but there's no new economy and no new jobs.
We'll be right back. We got a hard break with Jeremy Rifkin.